The Metal AI Podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Felix Beecher, and this is the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We talk to a range of top guests, from industry innovators to scientists to philosophers. This is brought to you by Informatech, where I'm the head of healthcare technology.
Okay, welcome everybody. I'm Andrew Brosnan, and I'm standing in for Felix today as the interviewer for the Medical AI Podcast. Today we'll be discussing an interesting use of medical AI, one that involves predicting the future, in particular predicting future outcomes of clinical trials, which has been suggested to have significant benefits for patients because this could be the basis for precision medicine. But don't think you're going to get away from Felix that easily because he's on the other end of the microphone. Welcome, Felix.
Thanks, Andrew. It's a great introduction.
Perhaps you could begin by telling us a bit about your background in clinical research.
Sure. I mean, I've been in clinical research for over 20 years. I started with my PhD at the Institute of Psychiatry in London, and that was on developing brain-based diagnostics for Alzheimer's disease using MRI. But in recent years, I've been immersing myself in medical AI, and around the time when I think machine learning was really starting to show its power for medicine. And then currently, of course, I am the head of healthcare technology at Informa, and medical AI obviously continues to be a big interest.
We'll come on to more about the concept of using machine learning for predicting outcomes of clinical trials. But first, you know, perhaps you could explain a little bit your motivation behind getting into this area.
I was working in clinical research, and through a curious twist of fate, COVID really made my career crash into a wall, and I was kind of left high and dry. And I decided to have for myself a sabbatical for a year, which I would use for whatever I wanted within medical AI. And it's one of those opportunities that doesn't come around very often at all. And so because I had a particular interest in clinical trials and drug development, what I decided to do was start up a project on using machine learning for predicting clinical trials. And I mean, the reason that that's such an important idea is firstly for its application in precision medicine, but also because it could have radical implications for how we develop drugs in general. And I also have to add that despite the importance of this concept, nobody had actually successfully done this before. So I felt like I had spotted an important gap in the scientific literature.
So why don't you give us a little bit about how drugs, the process of drug development?
Sure. Okay, to start from the very beginning, what tends to happen is that somebody has a hypothesis, you know, an idea for how a particular disease might be able to be treated in a new way. Maybe for prostate cancer, which we can talk more about, it might be an androgen receptor, for example. And the idea might simply be that if you can modulate the activity of that particular receptor, you would have a new therapeutic agent, and maybe that would be an improvement on what is already around. Following on from that, then there's a search for a molecule that will interact with that androgen receptor. Now, that search for a molecule can happen in all sorts of different ways. I mean, it tends to involve in different ways sifting through potentially thousands or even hundreds of thousands of different molecules until one comes up which is of interest. So suddenly you have a potential drug candidate. And then after that, you have a stage of preclinical testing, which is usually done on rats. Sometimes it's done on different animals, depending on the disease. And after that preclinical testing on rats, then a decision is made about whether this looks like a viable molecule for exploration in humans. And then that's the point at which clinical trials in humans starts. Now, phase one clinical trials tend to be very small. They're on healthy people, and they're really looking at just safety. phase two clinical trials are bigger, they're on patients, and they are taking a provisional look at efficacy and safety. And then you get the final stage of research, which is phase three clinical trials, which involves thousands of patients typically. They are extremely expensive, but they're very well controlled, and they're also definitive. So if a drug looks like it has passed the phase three clinical trial, that is the point at which the drug company would take that drug to a regulator who would then review the evidence, and then hopefully they would approve it for market. So that's a potted summary of how drug development works.
And so what are some of the challenges or problems with the way this system currently works?
From the point of view of the drug company, probably the most fundamental difficulty is that the whole process is phenomenally expensive. And there have been a few studies trying to estimate the extent of the expense of drug development, but those estimates have tended to be between $1 and $3 billion. Per drug, which is a phenomenal amount of money. So that's number one. Look, another major issue is that even having gone through that extremely expensive process of drug development, there is simply no guarantee, or even anything close to a guarantee, that the drug will pass. They often get rejected, which would mean potentially that the entire research process and all that expense has been wasted. Oncology is a good example, because something like a third of oncology drugs fail at that phase three stage. Ultimately, these costs of drug development are going to be passed on to the consumer and or the taxpayer. So there are major problems in terms of cost. The second big problem is that a lot of the time the drugs don't work very well.
So drugs aren't always that effective in all patients. Can you explain a little bit further, please?
Yes. There are two main metrics when it comes to assessing drugs from the point of view of patients and regulators. And the first is efficacy. In other words, how good the drug is at treating a disease or a condition. And the second is drug safety. Now, currently, there are major issues with both metrics. If you look at studies assessing how efficacious new drugs are, or how far new drugs represent an improvement on existing treatments, then some of those estimates would say that only 30% of new drugs represent a significant improvement on existing treatments. And other studies would say actually that is as low as 8%. Only 8% of new drugs represent an improvement in terms of efficacy on existing treatments. That's very low. So that's efficacy. And then the second one is drug safety. And again, of course, there are studies on this, but the studies vary in terms of their estimates on drug safety. But I think a fairly safe kind of ballpark is that in the US, there are around 3 million serious adverse drug reactions to pharmaceutical treatments every year. And that includes around 130,000 deaths. Now, that is a very big problem. That would make pharmaceutical adverse events the third leading cause of death in the US after heart disease and cancer. And I hope those statistics are kind of shocking.
Yes, I had no idea the numbers were that big.
Yeah, right.
Yes, and I think in the news recently, we've seen a lot about this concept of precision medicine. And could you explain a little bit about what exactly precision medicine is?
Probably the easiest way to do that is to start with what precision medicine is not, Ashley. So you could say that the standard model of medicine is what's called the one-size-fits-all model. A patient may come to a doctor with a particular condition. And the doctor may think, I know what the condition is, and I have maybe three or four options for treating it. But the doctor has really very little or no idea which of those three or four drug treatments are going to work best. Because it may be that one of them is going to work, but the other two will cause horrific side effects. Or it may be all of them work, or maybe none of them work. I mean, the doctor is kind of in the dark. And so typically what will happen is the doctor might just go down in order of his preference, these drug treatments. But what precision medicine aims to do is take the characteristics of that particular patient and match it with the best drug based on evidence. That's the crucial idea.
And so how would you characterize the application or adoption of precision medicine in clinical practice today?
There are examples of precision medicine which have been reviewed by regulators and are implemented in clinical practice. Probably the most famous one, because I think it was the first, was the certain types of drug for breast cancer were approved within women who had particular gene mutations. So the mutations were for the BRCA1 and the BRCA2 genes. Now, these are tumor-suppressing genes. So you can see that this is a good example of precision medicine, because you're selecting treatment on the basis of an individual's characteristics. But in general, precision medicine remains something of an ambition rather than something that's done in clinical practice. And that's a problem. And it's a problem that's very well recognized, but progress on this has been somewhat slow.
So how can artificial intelligence help in furthering precision medicine? And can you explain a little bit about what your research was in this area?
I mean, first of all, let me say that I didn't do all this research on my own. I kind of put together a small but brilliant team. I had Lily Mahika-Parodi, who's a professor at Harvard and Stony Brook University, Helena Slammer, who's an internal medicine doctor, Leo Ancora, who's now a PhD student in Lisbon, and Shreyash Gupta from Hyderabad. The first thing that we did was source some data, and the disease that I chose here was prostate cancer. And the reason I chose prostate cancer is, firstly, it was opportunistic. You know, I happened to be able to find three clinical trials from AstraZeneca, which I was able to merge. So it gave us a really nice data set to work with. And the other reason I chose prostate cancer was because I wanted to choose something that was an important disease, obviously just for men, but nonetheless important. The principle of the research was to do what I just mentioned. It was right to get all of the data that we could in a nice form, everything from concomitant meditations to age, sex, disease type, disease history, everything. Put it all together into a machine learning model. And the question is very, very simple. Could we predict 2 years in advance who would respond positively to treatment and who would not?
And what was the outcome?
Now, remember that if you're making predictions like this, the choice is between a coin flip and 100% accuracy. The crucial result was that we were able to predict treatment success 76% of the time. Now, there's a couple of things to say about that. Firstly, you know, people who are interested in medical AI have become used to reading about clinical studies where machine learning models can achieve like 99% accuracy. Maybe 90% accuracy is a bad one, or sometimes 100% accuracy. And so we've kind of got used to these very, very high levels of accuracy. But I think 76% is actually really great, because what we're trying to address here is a very difficult problem, which is predicting outcomes 2 years in advance. So, I mean, to me, that was a great success.
So sort of predicting the outcome before you even go into patients.
Yeah, not just before, 2 years in advance. I mean, which is, you know, so it's a very difficult question. And that's a comment. First of all, on the, you know, how machine learning models can process unlimited variety of types of data, but also the amazing flexibility with which machine learning can be applied. I think it's a really, really nice example of what I would call non-conventional medical AI.
So how would this principle be applied in real-world practice?
So our work provided a basis for assessing the likely success of one treatment for prostate cancer. It's a drug called bicalutamide. But if you repeated the same process for other drug treatments for prostate cancer in this case, then what you could do is compare those treatment options in terms of safety and efficacy for each individual patient. So the way it might work in practice is that either a patient or a doctor, they would log onto a web form and they could enter patient details, the kind of data that the algorithm was trained on, the kind of things we talked about before, disease history, blood chemistry, concomitant medications, and so forth. And then you click a button saying, give me my results, please. And then essentially what you get is a readout. So your top drug might be drug B, and it would give you potentially the chance of treatment success. And maybe that would be 80%. And then it would give you the chance of serious adverse effects, which may be 15%. And then the second choice might be drug A. And there the chance of treatment success would be 60%. And the chance of serious adverse effects would be 40%, and so forth. So it could give you a ranking of different treatment options. And that's roughly what I would envisage. And the one thing I really like about this is it's almost like magic what we're doing with machine learning here, because we have managed to increase levels of efficacy and drug safety, but we haven't made any changes whatsoever to the drug. We have simply managed to target the drug in an intelligent way.
And so you are sort of the first group to demonstrate this, but do you have any indication that it's catching on, or companies and regulators looking into this?
I mean, the paper is very successful. It got read thousands of times. At the same time, I was asking myself this question. I mean, maybe it was impatient because it was just only published, but I wanted to know, of course, what pharma companies and regulators thought about this idea. And so I did speak to key people in those kind of organizations. First of all, what I'd say is that I didn't think I really encountered any meaningful objection to the principle. Everyone was really impressed with the basic idea. People who tend to be heading up data science departments in big pharma companies are very smart people. So yes, I think they are exploring this, but I think they're exploring it in a very ginger, tentative kind of way. Now, interestingly, when I then spoke to people in the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, which is the regulatory body for the European Union, those people hadn't heard of this concept. Now, I happen to know that in the FDA, however, this concept has been written about in abstract terms. So the idea is out there. I think it's percolating through, but I think we're some way from seeing a change where companies run clinical trials on this basis and produce precision treatments. And I guess, look, part of the reason for that is that what is needed to get there is a kind of radical realignment of pharma companies and regulators. And that's not an easy thing to achieve. But I would say, I think that the concept is so strong that I'm sure that changes will occur in that direction. I think for me, the main question is the pace of change.
And I mean, do you think that having adequate data available is part of the challenge? Or is it more sort of getting these AI workflows integrated into existing processes?
I think getting these kind of processes implemented in clinical trials, relatively speaking, is pretty straightforward. I think the main thing would be persuading regulators and perhaps patients in the medical profession that this is a sensible idea. And the reason I say that is because it's just such a big change, and people in healthcare are naturally pretty conservative. In terms of getting the data, it's a good question, Andrew, because I think there has been a lot of progress in terms of getting good clinical data sets available to the public. Because there are, like, think about it, there are millions and millions of people all over the world working on machine learning, including medical AI. And of course, you know, machine learning is not fundamentally very difficult to do. It's more difficult to get good, curated, sensible, big enough data. That's why it's a really good question. Also, phase three clinical trial data, very, very expensive. Companies don't necessarily want to just let go of that, right? Because it has implications potentially for intellectual property. So it's a complex area. And I really hope that there is more availability of data down the line, because I think it would be a real boom to those people, you know, like myself, who were working in small independent research groups to help develop medical AI systems.
Yeah, and I think that there's some governmental initiatives in particularly in the UK, right, around sort of helping to build these comprehensive data sets. Is that right?
I think so, and there should be. And I think that the regulator in the UK, the MHRA, are very much aware of this idea. Now, I don't really know the legal ins and outs of how that interacts with intellectual property rights. That's a really complex question and probably one for lawyers.
So if this type of approach was broadly adopted by the industry, how would that change the landscape of drug development?
Well, the real prize ultimately here is, of course, the development of drugs which were more safe and effective or efficacious. I think there are a couple of more things that I could say about that, though. I mean, the process of drug development would also be more efficient in the sense that because you would suddenly be dealing with effect sizes that are bigger because you're targeting patients in a more intelligent way, that could mean that you could have phase three clinical trials that are smaller, and because they're smaller, they're less costly, and they're also quicker because you're having to recruit and run through fewer patients through your trial. But more fundamentally, I think that if this were broadly adopted, it could shake up the competitive nature of drug development as well. It could really change competitive dynamics, I would say.
Yes, and I assume that drugs would make it out into the market sooner.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think so. And I think it's very important to consider what this kind of approach would look like from the perspective of drug companies, because if this doesn't make financial sense to for-profit drug companies, then of course this kind of thing would simply never happen. So it's a very important question. Would companies have a financial incentive to follow this kind of approach? And the answer is not necessarily obvious, because you are suddenly developing a drug with the better profile in terms of efficacy and safety. But on the other hand, you're targeting only a subgroup of patients. So you could be having fewer patients for this particular treatment. So this requires a bit of thought, I think. Look, we could consider it in terms of two extreme examples, right? The unprofitable scenario is where you have a drug which is very dominant. It is, say, let's say 50% of the market. And then afterwards, if you have targeted your drug to a particular type of subgroup as identified by your machine learning algorithm, maybe suddenly you are only targeting 10% of the market. So clearly it's not going to be profitable. On the other hand, it's very easy to imagine a scenario where it is profitable. Because let's say that a market for a particular drug is split equally by 10 companies, and each of these drugs have a similar level of safety and efficacy. So each company has 10% market share each. Now, let's say that one company is thinking, let's develop our drug for a particular subgroup identified by an algorithm. Now, maybe that subgroup is only 50% of all patients with that disease, but because the safety and efficacy profile is better, you could capture that whole 50%. So instead of having 10% of the market, you could have 50% of the market, and clearly that's a big commercial opportunity.
Well, I think what the risk you have here is that, you know, you end up with a black box and not having a lot of transparency or visibility into how the algorithm is selecting patient cohorts.
No, I think that's exactly right, Andrew. And I think this is a big issue. If we think about how drug stratification sometimes works currently, a company will market a drug, and then it'll do some post-marketing research onto whether a particular genotype or males or females, whether there's a difference there, and whether there's a basis for intelligently prescribing drugs based on those kind of fairly crude stratifications. Now, I think what we showed in our paper was that you can do that in principle much more accurately using a machine learning algorithm. But you're absolutely right. You lose visibility about what you're doing. So this is really a major issue. And look, my personal feeling is that people probably should lose a bit of their fear of the unknown when it comes to black boxes and take an empirical approach. But I know this is controversial, and I think this is probably one of the major issues that this kind of approach is going to face.
Okay, Felix, well, you know, thank you so much for taking us through, you know, your project and your insights on using AI to predict outcomes in clinical trials. So for the last question, to wrap up, do you have any sort of favorite examples of medical AI currently in use?
Yes, I do. But before I say what it is, I'm going to just very briefly say what it isn't, kind of. Obviously, ChatGPT is talked about endlessly at the moment, and for very good reason, in my opinion. I think that large language models have a huge amount of potential for healthcare. And I think that it's probably going to be 2 or 3 years before we've really got to grips with what those implications are. But because it's too much a cliche, I'm not going to go for that. I'm also very interested in this idea of kind of cheap and easy AI systems that are in your pocket. And what I mean by that is AI systems that can be implemented on your phone. And I think a really nice example of that is AI systems which have been developed for diagnosing Parkinson's disease. And the way that they do that is simpler than you can imagine. All that is done is that you record your voice for a certain amount of seconds saying a particular thing, and then a machine learning model can run those voice data through a model and diagnose Parkinson's or not. It's just a very simple, nice, powerful example. And the reason I say that, by the way, is that there have been several studies that have shown that that can be done with something like 99% accuracy. Now, the current process for diagnosing Parkinson's disease goes a bit like this. First, you would have an interview with your doctor about symptoms, medical history, and family history. And then you would have a neurological exam to test for reflexes and balance, muscle strength. Then you'd probably have a blood test to rule out conditions like thyroid problems. And finally, you'd have a CT or an MRI scan to look at changes in brain pathology. And then all of that information would be taken together to give a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. Now, clearly, all of that takes a lot of time and a lot of money. So the idea that you could replace all of that by 20-second recording of your voice is kind of mind-blowing.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Felix. That was really insightful. And we'll keep posted on further developments in the space.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. I'm Felix Beecher. Ping me on LinkedIn for more information on Omdia's services in healthcare technology. See you next time.